Hey, it's Kim Masters, host of The Business at KCRW. We're going to start the podcast in just a few seconds, but first I want to ask you for your support. You are listening to this podcast for free, but guess what? It's not free to produce. So if you enjoy the show, please send us some support. Send us $10 by texting KCRW to the number 20222. One more time, text KCRW to the number 20222. Thanks so much, and here's the show. From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I didn't want a job on another television comedy, even though I had had such a great time on Third Rock from the Sun. I wanted to do other things, and convincing people that you can do something that they haven't seen you do before is very difficult.
Actor Joseph Gordon-Levitt returns to television with a new kind of variety show created by his company, Hit Record. Thousands of artists contribute online, and they even get paid. Then an indie producer gives an unknown writer a Sundance education. But first, on the Hollywood News Banter, a bit of what went on at Sundance this year. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by a guest fellow banterer, Ben Fritz of The Wall Street Journal. Hello, Ben.
Hi, Kim.
So, Ben, you and I were both just in Sundance, enjoying the clear, cool air of Park City, Utah, and seeing some movies. You have been doing some reporting on the state of Sundance this year. In the past, we've seen some wild and crazy bidding, some huge numbers a few years ago in 2006, over $10 million for Little Miss Sunshine, which, of course, went on to be a huge hit. Yeah. Just last year, The Way, Way Back sold for how much?
It was $9.75 million.
Big deal. Yeah. Nothing like that this year, though.
No more. The biggest deal this year was about $3 million. So the quantity was the same. We've seen 13 so far movies sold and more in the works, which is pretty standard. But there was really nothing with breakout commercial potential in the eyes of the buyers and agents who I spoke to. It seemed like it was a little bit more of an arty avant-garde kind of year rather than a Little Miss Sunshine kind of year.
Yeah, and this is somewhat deliberate, right? I mean, John Cooper, who programs the festival, has said in the past, I want to take Sundance away from this swag-laden orgy of commercialization. And it seems like he's done it.
Yeah, he's done that. And then at the same time, you see other festivals like Toronto that are getting really commercial movies and having bigger deals. The biggest movie at Toronto this year was Can a Song Save Your Life, which sold for $7 million. And I think a few years ago, the idea that there would be a much bigger deal at Toronto than at Sundance, it would have seemed crazy.
You know, it's kind of funny because there's this sort of horse race thing about what sold for how much. And, yeah. And they're ignoring this, the stated mandate that the people who do the Sundance Film Fest and the founder, Robert Redford, have expressed.
Absolutely. Yeah. The people who are running the festival are thinking about one thing. And most of the people at Sundance, you know, are not journalists. They're not buyers. They're regular film fans who get themselves there somehow and buy tickets. And I think they were probably really satisfied. The critics gave a lot of great reviews to movies this year. The buzz was really good about a lot of really interesting movies. They're just not movies that people think can play at 3,000 theaters nationwide and gross $50 million.
Well, one of the bigger deals that we should talk about is the one that Zach Braff hit for his film, Wish I Was Here. We had him on the show earlier to defend his Kickstarter campaign. A lot of people were critical. As he said at the Q&A following the premiere of the movie, he had been warned that he might get his ass kicked for going to Kickstarter by one of the producers of the film because he is famous and rich and has a lot of fans. Yep. This movie got a pretty good ride, huh?
Sure. The movie sold for a pretty good amount of money this year. It sold for $2.7 million, which, given the state of the festival this year, is quite strong. And perhaps more importantly, Focus Features promise that they're going to release the movie in at least 500 theaters nationwide, which means that most people will have a chance to see it and means they'll have to spend a pretty good amount of money, you know, tens of millions of dollars in marketing. So that's a pretty big commitment and more than any other movie got. So it all worked out well for Zach Braff and his investors. Whether or not the Kickstarter people feel that they got their money's worth, I guess, remains to be seen.
Well, they will get – we heard tell – I don't know if it was actually true that some of the Kickstarter people were actually there and couldn't get into the premiere,
right,
which
yes.
was
oh, – yeah.
I will say that the critics have been seriously mixed on the movie. But in that room, it played great. You know, people were laughing and crying. Mm-hmm. It was emotional. You know, Focus Features is had been the art house label
right.
of Universal. And Peter Schlesel took that over. And a lot of people were thinking he's been doing more genre movies.
Right.
I think people were looking to see – I certainly expected him to be a strong bidder for this movie for a particular reason.
Right. Well, it's kind of the perfect movie for them in the sense that they really needed to plant their flag and show what kind of movies they're going to do. And on the one hand, people still want to see that Focus is a buyer at Sundance. They don't want to think they've abandoned it. But Focus is not going to go buy a super arty movie. So what did they buy? They bought sort of the most obviously commercial movie at Sundance, which is from the director who made Garden State, which was an indie hit a few years ago. And, you know, and it has all this Kickstarter attention already. So if you're going to go in and buy a movie that you think will do well and it's not too artsy, I think this was the most obvious one to go for.
Yeah, pretty safe bet. Is there any other movies you feel like that are going to be, you know, making noise out there in the world?
Well, from a lot of people I talked about, I think one of the movies that has a lot of commercial potential is Laggies, which stars Keira Knightley. It's a romantic comedy with her and Sam Rockwell and Chloe Grace Moretz. And Keira is trying to escape her current life, and she goes and hangs out with a bunch of teenagers. It was bought by A24, which is a very new company. They're only 2 years old. They're privately backed. And they haven't had any massive hits so far, but I think they really believe in this. And they're really into online marketing. They don't spend a lot on marketing. And they're, you know, this, I think, has the potential for a breakout hit. And if it's a breakout hit for A24 as opposed to traditional studio like Fox Searchlight or Focus, it'll really put them on the map.
Yeah. Previously, they've had Bling Ring, which didn't put them on the map, and Spring Breakers, which a little bit.
Right.
And Lynn Shelton is the director. She's a sort of a veteran indie director at this point, and this is probably her most commercial play.
Absolutely.
Ever. So there were some movies in the art world that, again, not hugely commercial, but are definitely going to be of interest to art house fans. I would say Boyhood from Richard Linklater, extraordinary, unusual project.
Oh, yeah. It's an amazing achievement. It's a 2-hour, 40-minute or so movie. It kind of chronicles a boy's life from age 6 to 18, and it is the same actors. So Linklater went back every year, shot for 5 days with the same kid and with Patricia Arquette and Ethan Hawke as his parents. And you actually see them aging over time as opposed to seeing, you know, different actors cast as the same person, which you would traditionally see. And it has this really naturalistic feel, and it's kind of beautiful and touching in a way that you can't achieve when you have different actors, I think. All that said, it doesn't have much conflict. It doesn't have a traditional plot. It's very hard to imagine that movie playing nationwide and making a lot of money.
There were a lot of very promising, strong documentaries, I thought, too. Dinosaur 13 in particular. I did not get to see it, but it's apparently about this guy who discovered this amazing dinosaur fossil, and then his life is just absolutely turned upside down.
Right. It's an interesting story. With the first half hour is about him discovering this amazing T-Rex fossil, and then half an hour in, it becomes about the fight over who owns the fossil. It's this great conflict. And what's interesting, documentaries, even really good ones, often struggle at the box office. It's a very tough genre for most people to go pay for a ticket. So Lionsgate bought it in conjunction with CNN, the news network, which has a division called CNN Films that's about a year old. And they made a deal together where Lionsgate's going to premiere theatrically, and CNN will have all the television rights and premiere it very soon after on TV. And together, they bid almost $1 million and sort of made a deal they think will work economically for them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kim.
Ben Fritz covers the entertainment business for The Wall Street Journal. Coming up later in the show, an aspiring writer takes a break from his day job at the UPS store to tag along with producer Cassian Elwes at Sundance. But first, actor Joseph Gordon-Levitt makes a new TV show with collaborators from around the world. Joseph Gordon-Levitt had a busy career as an actor until he didn't. He got famous as a teenager playing the extraterrestrial Tommy Solomon on the NBC comedy Third Rock from the Sun. But then...
I was in my early 20s and I'd been an actor my whole life, and I quit for a couple of years to go to college. And when I wanted to get back into it, I couldn't get a job, which was quite discouraging, of course. And I realized at that time that I had to take responsibility for my own creativity. I couldn't just wait around for somebody to tell me I was allowed to make things. You know, I figured I love this too much. I have to do it myself.
So in 2005, Gordon-Levitt and his older brother Dan, who died 5 years later, started creating short films and songs online and soliciting feedback and input from anyone who cared to offer it. That evolved into Hit Record, what the brothers called an open collaborative production company. By now, hundreds of thousands of people from around the globe have produced music, books, and video with Hit Record. Gordon-Levitt eventually resurrected his acting career and made his way onto the big screen with films including 500 Days of Summer, 50-50, and Looper. He went on to work behind the camera, too. Last year, his directorial debut, Don John, premiered at Sundance and was acquired for $4 million. But Gordon-Levitt also stuck with Hit Record, which earlier this month launched its biggest project to date, Hit Record on TV. Joseph Gordon-Levitt hosts and directs the show, and each episode has a theme. The first, titled Regarding the Number One, explores that single digit in material from a short film about a young woman with an eye condition who gets to see the stars for the first time, to this song, which ends the show. You're not the only one, not the only one. The show airs on Pivot, the new cable television network started by the socially conscious entertainment company Participant Media, and has already been renewed for a second season. The business producer, Darby Maloney, recently sat down with Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
The way you describe Hit Record is as this open, collaborative production company.
Yep.
And in that community, your name is Regular Joe.
Right.
Okay. So tell me about that.
Okay.
Why? How'd you choose that moniker?
Regular Joe. Yeah, it's a bit of a double entendre, I guess. I mean, certainly part of it is, you know, being regular, like a normal person, but regular also in that I sort of set up the rules and regulations. For example, one of the rules on our site is anything you put up here is allowed to be remixed, refined, revised, sampled, re-recorded, rewritten. Everything's up for grabs, and that's how we collaborate. And so I established that rule at the very beginning. When you join our site, there's a video of me making this very explicit. Because, you know, in our culture, a lot of people would get huffy if you're like, wait, I wrote that. You can't rewrite it. The fact that I established that as the rule from the beginning means that, hey, you agreed to it already. You know this is the deal at the outset. And so people don't get upset about it. People actually get excited and honored when someone takes something that they've done and builds on it.
So I went to one of your recording sessions, I guess. I don't know how you'd put it.
We were calling them venue shoots.
Okay.
Yeah,
I went to a venue shoot.
Yeah.
You were hosting it, obviously, which anybody will see when they see the show. But what you don't see unless you're at one of these venue shoots is how much you're directing it. And I kept thinking, like, how is he keeping all this straight in his head? You know, and then at one point you're playing the piano and then you're playing the drums and, you know, you're hopping off the stage and you've got a camera.
Yeah.
And you're shooting people and you've directed like a third of the audience to shoot you and a third of the audience to shoot whoever else is on stage and a third of the audience to shoot each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like thinking, the future editing process is going to be incredible, but the present process that's afoot in his mind is tremendous, how you're keeping it all straight.
It's interesting you bring up editing, because actually that's what I'm thinking about constantly while we're doing our venue shoots, is how are we going to cut this later? And I taught myself to edit starting in, for my 21st birthday, actually, was when I got myself my first copy of Final Cut, the video editing software. And that was a huge transition for me. I would highly recommend anybody who's interested in any part of the filmmaking process, whether it's as an actor or writer or a production, to anybody, learn to edit. Because that is really when you start taking footage and turning it into a movie.
There's all these interesting juxtapositions, like you're this leader, but you're Regular Joe, but you've got the collaboration, but you definitely have a really clear vision.
And that same thing is the case on a film set, on a traditional film set. And the way that our production company is set up is modeled after a film set with a director. And a director, even a traditional director like Steven Spielberg, as much as he is bringing to the table and as much talent and vision as he does, he can't make the movie without all these other artists that he's collaborating with. And that's kind of what Hit Record is like. I didn't mean to just compare myself to Steven Spielberg, but it's a collaboration, and lots of artists are bringing their ideas and their, you know, images, their songs, their words to the table. But I direct it. And I think having the voice of an individual directing it is a big part of what makes it what it is.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with Joseph Gordon-Levitt, whose new show, Hit Record on TV, premiered earlier this month. More than 400 people contributed to that first episode, and each person got paid. Gordon-Levitt tells us how his company determines who gets what.
The way we do it is every episode has $50,000 of its budget dedicated to paying the contributing artists. So, for example, the first episode has 426 artists whose work is featured in the final version of the episode. Those 426 people will share the $50,000. It won't be divided evenly. We have to go through each one of those 426 and figure out what is the fair percentage for them to get. And in fact, what we do is we first come up with a proposal and we list out those 426 people with what they did and what their percentage is, and we post that on our site, and we open it up to discussion for 2 weeks.
And anybody in the community can say, well, I think that this person maybe deserves a little more or less. Or someone can say, hey, you forgot me. And after that two-week window, once we've weighed our opinion of what's fair, then we post the final profits and then we send out checks.
So everybody, it's transparent. Everybody knows what everyone gets.
Our goal is always to try to keep that process as transparent as we possibly can. Yeah, because you really do have to trust us. And I think we deserve that trust. And we don't have anything to hide. And so we do it out in the open.
We've talked about how working in traditional show business may have influenced or has influenced in different ways the way you go about hit record on TV and hit record writ large. I'm also curious about your family's influence. I know your parents are sort of lefties and they worked at the radio station, KPFK. It's kind of very much known as a community radio station. It's now part of the NPR world. Mm-hmm. I know you started the hit record process with your brother.
That's right.
So I wonder how much we see on screen is reflective of the sort of ethic of community and creativity that you grew up in.
Yeah. Well, thanks. I love that you asked me that, so thank you. For sure, my parents brought my brother and me up to have those values that, you know, some people would call common sense, but other people might call lefty. That values like sharing tends to be a good thing to do. Seeing yourself as part of something larger and understanding that it's in one's own interest to look out for the larger community and not just look out for your own self. And understanding that to really do anything great, it takes, you know, I guess the saying is it takes a village. Not only was I brought up to believe that, that has been confirmed by my experience. And that is a lot of the ethic that's behind Hit Record, is can we do this in a way that's less exclusive, that's less hierarchical than Hollywood, even though there is, I guess you could say, a hierarchy in that I'm directing it. You know, can we do this in a way that opens those doors, that allows artists from all over the world who don't necessarily have entree or connections in the established industry, can we include them? And it's been enormously rewarding. And not only for the principle of it, it's been enormously rewarding because the truth is there are lots of great artists who will do great work outside of Hollywood. I mean, the short film you brought up earlier that's called First Stars I See Tonight, it's a true story that this young woman wrote about her life, about how she grew up with this eye condition and she couldn't see the stars. And then when she was 16, her dad bought her this pair of night vision goggles from a Russian military surplus catalog. Okay, so if I had hired a room full of Hollywood screenwriters and said, write me a short film on the theme of the number one, they would have never come up with that. So opening that door and being inclusive allows for those beautiful things to happen. And that is very much at the heart of what my parents brought me up to do. And I think my brother and I, as we started it, did our best to instill our project with those values. And it's rewarding.
Is there any risk on the other side? I mean, there's so much rejection in Hollywood. With every 426 contributors you accept, there's countless that don't get a piece of the action.
You're right about that. You're right about that. I guess that's that's the business, right?
That was the business producer Darby Maloney talking with Joseph Gordon-Levitt. To see the first episode of his television show, Hit Record on TV, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness. Coming up, an aspiring screenwriter takes a break from his day job at a UPS store after winning a trip to Sundance. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We spent a few days at the Sundance Film Festival last week, saw a few movies, and caught up with independent producer Cassian Elways. This past year, he partnered with Franklin Leonard, founder of The Blacklist, to award a screenwriting fellowship to an unknown writer. For some years, the Blacklist has polled industry professionals to come up with an annual ranking of the best unproduced scripts in Hollywood. Lately, it's expanded into a year-round website where writers can upload their scripts and get feedback from industry professionals. In an effort to find more undiscovered talent, Elwes and Leonard created a fellowship that would go to a writer who didn't have an agent or manager and who'd made less than $5,000 from writing. The prize included a trip to Sundance with Elwes. Formerly an agent at William Morris, Elwes has become an independent producer whose credits this year include Dallas Buyers Club, Lee Daniels' The Butler, and All Is Lost. The first ever fellowship winner, Matthew Hickman, originally from Georgia, has worked at a UPS store in Santa Monica for the past 3 years. We met up with Hickman and Elwes between screenings at the Sundance Film Festival.
I've always thought it's a very, very hard business to break into, and particularly hard for young writers. Young directors can make shorts. Agents, which I used to be one, traditionally have ADD, and it's very hard for them to look at anything for more than 3 minutes. So to actually get them to read a script of a young writer who they don't even know is almost impossible. And so that was where I started thinking about the fact that all the movies that I worked on, how brilliant the scripts were, how those writers got started. And I thought as something that I could do in my own little way would be to find a new young voice and show them the ropes, bring them into the business somehow or other in a way that they couldn't before.
Okay, so Matthew, this appears to be you. Now tell us about your life. You were obviously wanting to be a writer, but mm-hmm. having to earn a living.
I was in law school at the University of Georgia. I only made it about 6 weeks in before I realized, you know, you could probably do this, but it's going to be a ton of hard work. And I just didn't want to put that much work into something that I wasn't incredibly passionate about. And writing had always been the only thing that I knew I was willing to sacrifice almost anything for. And I knew that at that moment it was now or never. And so I made the decision to leave law school, and I got the first job I could find, which in the fall of 2009 was, with the economy not doing that well, there weren't that many choices out there. And I got a job at a UPS store that was owned by an acquaintance of mine. And I started out that first holiday season making close to minimum wage, and worked there for a year to save enough money to move here, and was very fortunate in that I was able to find a job at another UPS store before I moved here.
By here you mean LA, although we are currently, of course, at Sundance.
That's right, yeah. And I kind of consciously made a choice to not try and get a job in the industry because I wanted to know that if I ever did amount to anything as a writer, I guess, I only wanted to think that it was due to something that I had written.
And did your family go, are you kidding? You're kidding? You're quitting law school and doing what?
Oh, my mom cried a lot. a lot. She's a single mother. I'm an only child. She always told me that I could do whatever I wanted when I was a kid. And we've had several conversations about how, in her mind, that meant you can be a doctor or a lawyer if you want to. And I think I just believed that a little too much when she told me.
So is she won over now, or is she still like, stay with the UPS store, dude? It's not time to quit quite yet.
She's both. She's won over, but she was skeptical about the amount of progress that I'd be able to make. She didn't think I couldn't do it, but she just knew that it's tough. And I think now she is firmly in the camp of being excited for me and wanting to know where this leads, which is, that is one of the most satisfying feelings possible.
So, what are you guys doing in Sundance?
We're seeing a lot of movies, we're meeting a lot of people, and I'm getting a crash course in how it all works. I mean, you know, as a writer, I've spent years trying to become a writer, but I don't know anything about the business of how movies are made. And to have someone like Cassian just be able to say, you know, this is how this happens, has been really great. I mean, we spent like 3 hours earlier this morning talking about some of the ways that he's gotten various movies made, and there's some really great war stories there.
So what is the main thing that you would like Matthew Cassian to learn here with you at Sundance?
Well, obviously, there's nothing about writing that I can teach him, but what I really want him to understand is the business of independent cinema, how films are made, how films get financed, how films get shown at film festivals, how they get bought. That's all part of his education as he goes forward in his life now, and people talk to him and come to him and try to option his work from him. He should understand very well what these people are saying and what's going to happen to his film.
So when you got the call from Cassian, what was going on? You were working away at the UPS store?
I found out I was a finalist and spent the next week or so writing what seemed like the 500 most important words I had ever written in my life for a personal statement to be read by Cassian. And about a week later, he called me one Friday evening, and it was the surreal phone call that every writer wants to get, but that eventually, if you are trying to make it in this business long enough, you stop thinking that it's going to happen that way. And it had been a pretty rough day. There was a customer at the store who I'd come to know pretty well over the past 2 years or so, and he wasn't in the best of health, and he died in our parking lot at the store. And so that was pretty heavy. And I got home, and I was feeling really awful, and I took my temperature, and I had a fever of like 100.5, and I started to nod off, and then my phone started ringing, and I was just like, whatever, whoever it is, I don't want to talk to you right now. And then it started ringing again a moment later, and then at that point, I was kind of worried. I was like, is something else going wrong? Like, does somebody need something? Is everything okay? And I looked at my phone, and it was a number that I didn't have saved in my phone from Beverly Hills. And my first thought was, I don't get phone calls from people that live in Beverly Hills at this time on a Friday night. And I knew that I was a finalist, and my thoughts immediately went there, and sure enough, it was him.
It sounds like, you know, the Ed McMahon moment, yeah, the publisher's clearinghouse moment.
I called the phone number, and it didn't answer right away, and then I tried it again. It's like, I'm sure this guy must be on the other end. And he'd written this incredibly beautiful letter about why he should go. And I was very moved by the whole thing, and I love the script so much, because it's really about a father-daughter relationship. It's about a girl who never knew who her father was and goes on, her mother dies at the beginning of the picture, and she goes to try to track him down and tell him that the mother has died, and why did he leave her when she was 5 months old. And I completely related to the whole father-daughter thing. So I wanted to do it on Friday afternoon because I'd read the scripts and finished them by Thursday. But my daughter, who's just moved to Los Angeles, who's 24, I wanted her to listen to the conversation too, because, as I said, I related to the whole father-daughter thing, and sometimes about, you know, how daughters get disappointed in their father. And I'm sort of tearing up now just thinking about it. But I wanted her to know that sometimes her dad does cool stuff. And in a way, I get just as much from this whole experience as he does, because I get to see Sundance from a fresh perspective. I've been coming here for 20 years now, and I get to see it with new eyes.
Matthew, have you quit your day job?
You know, I haven't. Not yet. I don't want to get too ahead of myself.
Had you done something before this to get in as a writer, or was this like first shot?
Not the first shot at all. I've been here for about 3 years now. I've written a couple of scripts. I'd even uploaded one of my scripts to the blacklist, and they tore it to pieces. And for a while, I was really kind of angry with the blacklist, and I thought, you know, they don't know good writing when they see it. But of course, that's totally wrong. I mean, when a script has their imprimatur, a script is going to be pretty much assured some kind of success. And they really taught me an important lesson, which was, don't chase what the industry is trying to do or what you think the industry is trying to do. Write what you love. And it's very cliche advice, and I've read it 1,000 times, but I kind of had to live that before I was willing to embrace the reality of it.
All right, Cassian, we're going to watch this space, right? We're going to see you at the Sundance premiere, hopefully, or some other place of this movie.
Well, that would be my dream, and I've been talking to Matthew about that, is to make this movie this year and bring him back next year with the next young writer that I'll bring next year, and he'll be able to see what Matthew was able to accomplish during the course of this year.
Well, thank you so much. Best of luck to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, really.
That was producer Cassian Elwes and writer Matthew Hickman at the Sundance Film Festival. And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to us anytime on demand with the KCRW smartphone apps, and you can hear the podcast on iTunes, TuneIn, or wherever you download podcasts. The show is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.